Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show. And Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, the environment and our energy systems and what we can do locally to change things and where the battlegrounds are and where the future is. We're here to looking today at the whole issue of food system sustainability and the amount the food we waste and what we can do about not wasting that food, how can we reclaim and we change the nature of how we get our food and change the nature of people's access to food. We're here with Ronnie Neff, who directs the Hopkins Center for a Livable Futures Food System Sustainability and Public Health Program. She's also an assistant professor in the Bloomberg School's Environmental Health Sciences Department and Health Policy and Management Departments, and her work focuses on food system sustainability and resilience. Ronnie, good to have you in studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Brenda Platt joins us by phone. She is the co-director of the Institute for Self-Reliance and leads their Composting for Community program, which is advancing composting to create jobs, enhance soils, sequester carbon, reduce waste, and build resilient communities. And she does some of her work right here in Baltimore and Curtis Bay, which we'll talk about a bit in the course of the conversation. And Brenda, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Good to be there.
So, Ronnie, let me just begin. So let's talk about the kind of this overview of what this issue of food waste is and just how extensive and large it is.
Yeah, so we waste in this country, we waste 40% of our food supply. So it's staggering. So it's this huge amount of money that we're spending on the food and resources that are going into the food that are basically ending up in the landfill.
So what do you mean, 40% of what? I mean, what does that mean, 40% we waste food? I mean, how do we waste it? What does it mean we waste 40% of our food?
Yeah, so starting from the very beginning at the farm level, well, in the United States, we don't even actually count how much food we waste at the farm level. But there's a lot, and then it goes
This is food that might look good. It might still be good to eat, but is just laid in the ground because it doesn't look a certain way and for other reasons?
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons, and some of it is that the farmers may feel that they're not it would cost more to harvest it than it would that they could get the price back from selling it. And sometimes it's that it's not considered up to the aesthetic standards of those who would purchase it. So a lot of this food basically just goes to waste and doesn't get harvested. And then it goes up, you go along through the food system and there's food processing. And food processing is actually one of the parts of the food system that's relatively good at finding ways to repurpose that food. And then it goes through the distribution and then into the retail and restaurant level. And there's a fair amount that gets wasted there. And then it comes to the consumers, and we are the place where the biggest amount of it is wasted. But a lot of the food that consumers throw out, you could say that it's not necessarily, you could put that on higher levels of the food system because, for example, how is that food packaged? If it's packaged in a way that causes us to throw out more food, is that the
What does that mean, packaged in a way that causes, what do you mean by that?
Well, for example, if you want to buy some product, something perishable, and it comes in a great big package, and you're only going to use a little bit of it, and you never use it up. And that's just routine. That happens to many people. That's just one example. So there's sometimes a tendency to treat it as a blame issue for consumers, and I think it's really important to look at the bigger picture of all the factors that lead to it.
And so, and Brenda, welcome to the show as well, Brenda Platt. And so talk a bit about, I mean, so what you're dealing with it on a national but also a community level of how you begin to address the issue, right?
Yeah, and you know the when we look at what like an average household puts out at the curb, you know, every week for trash collection, almost 50% is, I mean, this is the good news, is readily compostable or could be collected for composting. You know, out of a typical trash bag, 21% by weight is food scraps alone. And as Ronnie said, you know, a lot of that can be reduced and avoided to begin with, which is a first step. But another 15% is paperboard or food soiled paper, which actually can also be composted. And then further, we have like another 16% that's yard waste and wood waste. And we're very good actually nationally at composting our yard trimmings, our grass, our brush, and whatnot. But in Baltimore, the yard trimmings are actually incinerated, as is food waste. Ronnie mentioned landfills, which, you know, are a problem. But locally in Baltimore, you know, people's trash go to the local trash incinerator. So the good news is as I said, is half can be recovered for composting. And when you do that in a way that supports community and builds equity, you know, you can begin to enhance local soils, protect local watersheds, create local jobs and local workforce skills. And that's what we're working on. That's our real interest in this space.
So to me, there are two issues here. One issue is the waste that's created and accumulated because of the top-down nature in which the way we supply our food and package our food and sell our food and how it's done. That's one of the issues, which in some ways may be more difficult to attack and address than the other, which to me is how we can address that locally and what we can do to change the systems where we live. But as I said that, you were kind of shaking your head no or yes. I'm not sure what you were saying, but Ronnie, just about, I mean, because that isn't that part of the issue, though, that the way we handle things in a national way in terms of the corporate world and food, I mean, that is part of the issue, right?
Yes. I thought that that when you were going to characterize what was the second piece, that was individual behavior. And I'd say that sometimes it can be easier to change a whole system than to change individual behavior.
Right.
So that was why I was shaking my head.
No, it is, because we buy too much food sometimes. And as you said, the way it's packaged, you want to just get a quarter pound of spinach, you can't because it's in a bag that's a pound of spinach and you're stuck with it. And if you don't use it, you toss it out and it becomes waste.
And then there's also the factor that many of us are really very unaware of the food that we throw out. So, for example, I did this nationally representative consumer survey and we found that of the U.S. population, 73% said that they wasted less than the average American. And it's like the Lake Wobegon effect. And then 37% said that they wasted almost nothing. And yet we know, almost nothing across all six categories of food that we asked about. And yet we know that there's these vast quantities of food that are getting thrown out. So people are just not tuning into it. And so part of it is becoming aware. But then part of it is so embedded in the routines of our lives that are very, you know, you didn't finish your leftovers. You put them in the fridge. You forgot about them. 6 weeks later, they're green. Is that, you know, we're just not tracking it.
And then the added irony on top of that is we waste so much food. And at the same time, we have so many communities that are food insecure, that don't have access to healthy food, or a soil that's eroding and is desperate for more organic matter or soil fertility.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we have all these challenges of food insecurity, food access, the need for local healthy food or healthy soils. And here we're just, you know, sending, in the case of Baltimore, to the incinerator, these valuable, you know, assets, the food waste. So, you know, in addition to reducing the packaging, there's a lot we can do to be collecting it and diverting it and making it into compost, manufacturing it into compost, which is a soil amendment. It's not soil, but it's a soil amendment.
What do you mean, a soil amendment?
Well, compost by itself is alive with microorganisms, literally teeming with life. And there's a substance in compost called humus. It's like a glue that holds the soil particles together. So when you add it to soil and you mix it into your soil, you're helping the soil hold together. It's almost like a magic substance. So when it rains, less of it will wash away. In a drought condition, it's going to hold water. So, you know, given our, you know, increasingly varying, you know, weather patterns these days, whether it's drought or storms, adding compost to soil is going to help enhance it in either drought or, you know, excessive stormwater conditions. So it's not, you can't just, you know, put a plant in 100% compost. You know, the rule of thumb is like one-third compost you can add to your soil to enhance it. So it's not soil, but it's a soil amendment. You amend soil with it.
So let's tackle for a moment this question of, so what do we do? I mean, so the reality is 40%, as you said earlier, Ronnie. That's very real. So what do we do about that? What are the things locally you could do to change that, to ameliorate that, to limit the waste, make it more possible? There's composting, getting food to other people. Where do we begin?
Well, I would start with the EPA's food recovery hierarchy, which was sort of mentioned earlier, but it's this idea
as long as it stays funded, we'll see about that.
Let's
not even go there today, right?
The food recovery hierarchy,
Sorry, I mean to digress. Go ahead.
To fight for. But the idea is that the first step is prevention. It's sort of like this reduce, reuse, recycle concept. The first step is preventing that food from even having been purchased in the first place. And then you want to donate it to food that's still high quality to people. And then food that's lower quality, maybe to animals. And then going on to industrial uses, and then composting, and then, you know, incineration or landfill. So that's one way to think about it in terms of priority. But the other thing I want to say is that there's this group called ReFed that took a look at 27 different potential solutions for addressing food waste in the United States. And they said that if you put all these 27 together, you could cut food waste by 20% in 10 years. And they said that the most cost-effective solutions were, number one, changing date labels, that sell-by and use-by labels, mm-hmm. Which is in the process of happening through a voluntary agreement, and education. And then, so that's the most cost-effective. And then the way to keep the greatest amount of waste out of the landfill and incineration is things like composting and anaerobic digestion. And then there's a whole span of other things in the middle that can play a really important role also.
And I was thinking that with the work that you do with the Institute for Self-Reliance, Brenda, that I mean, they're probably both volunteer things, the things you just do to create them. But if there were ways that there were systems in place that actually promoted this kind of stuff that you try to promote at the Institute for Self-Reliance, that could change. You know, if locally, if we said that we have now laws that say you have to separate your garbage and put plastic in here and paper in here and your other waste material in this bag, that if we had something similar to that had to do with waste and really we're using waste, we could change the dynamic.
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons that recycling has become so popular in the last decade or so is because of the convenience. You know, giving everybody a container, having it be picked up weekly, you know, the same schedule as trash is key. And there are cities all across the country now, millions of people, that are served by curbside collection of food waste and yard waste together. So, and there's a number of communities actually in Maryland that are doing this. Prince George's County has started. Howard County has a very extensive pilot. The city of Tacoma Park was one of the early adopters, and it's growing.
Now, what do they do exactly in these communities? How does it work?
You get a bucket.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of the city of Tacoma Park, you get a bucket, a 7-gallon bucket with a screw top lid, and you can put all your food waste, meat, left. You know, it's not just, you know, produce and fruit scraps.
Right, right.
You can put anything, you know, your old science projects in the back of the refrigerator, you know, in there, and it gets collected weekly on the same day as recycling and trash. There's nothing that beats that convenience of doing that. So if we want to do a high, again, I think to Ronnie's point, we want to reduce it first. We want to rescue edible food. But what we can't reduce and rescue to feed people, we can compost and collect it, and it has to be convenient. One of the things that we also promote is training for home composting and making it, you know, a lot of Americans, a lot of Maryland residents like to garden. So it may only be, you know, maybe 1 in 10 household that might want a backyard compost, but let's not forget about them. If you don't have to pick it up, if a city like Baltimore doesn't have to pick up food scraps, for every ton they're avoiding, they're saving, you know, paying the incinerator that ton to burn it, let alone the, you know, the collection haulers. So that's a low-cost thing that any city can do, is promote home composting. And then one of the other things that we're doing more and more in is trying to encourage composting at schools, particularly K-12 schools, you know, engaging students, especially schools that have a garden, you know, teaching them the full life cycle of growing food, seeing food scraps, making it back into compost, and putting it back into their garden. And there's a win-win for this on many levels. Not only do young composters become old composters, so essential to reach these kids, you know, when they're young, but there's been some work that's demonstrated that when kids are growing their own food in a hands-on way, they're more likely to eat more healthfully. So, you know, it's really important to schools and getting kids involved. And one of the things that we're particularly interested now is doing kind of community-based composting in small scale rather than large-scale regional facilities. And this is part of the work I'm doing that you mentioned at the top of the show in Curtis Bay in Baltimore, is we're working with the Chesapeake Center for Youth Development and looking at a bike-powered food scrap collection program and community composting operation.
Wow.
In Curtis Bay, and it's not launched yet, but we are looking for some youth to that we can hire for this pilot project, who would like to be paid some money and do some collection and gain some workforce skills. So,
I mean, Curtis Bay is a story unto itself, and they've been ahead of the curve of a lot of things, but they've organized in that community, and I think that every chance we have, we kind of promote what they're doing there, because they really have some amazing things, and they're modeling for everybody else, which I think is really important that you all are there with them as well. I'm not surprised that this also started in Tacoma Park, which we affectionately call in Maryland the People's Republic of Tacoma Park.
That's right.
So I'm not surprised that it began there. So it seems to me that one of the things we have here, Ronnie, there are two separate streams, no pun intended. One is the getting food that we consider waste that can be used by people who don't have access to food, because it's not bad food. It's just food that we can talk a bit about that. And the other is the waste stream that Brenda just finished talking about, which is how we can reutilize waste so we can build compost and do more with it rather than just throwing it in the dump.
Absolutely.
Right? So we have both these ways. So talk about the former for a moment.
Mm-hmm. So just to put out some numbers, when we were talking earlier about the magnitude, I had run some calculations a while ago, and if we were to assume that Maryland wastes food at the same rate as the rest of the country, then we throw out in Maryland almost 1 ton of food for every food insecure person in the state.
Over a year period, you mean?
Yeah, 1,848 pounds.
Per person that lives in a food insecure life.
In Maryland, yeah. So it's just, it's staggering. And so...
Wow.
Of course, you know, there's significant portions of that food that could not be recovered, but there's a lot of really powerful initiatives that are going on to work on recovering it. And there's things going on at the farm level to, there's a project going on in Southern Maryland where they are aggregating the food from the farms and then, you know, bringing it to one place, and then they can take it to different food pantries and things like that. The Maryland Food Bank also has initiatives and is working closely with farmers. There are a lot of programs going on, for example, with campuses where they are gathering food from their own food services that's still good quality food and getting that distributed. There's a lot of different initiatives going on. There's some stuff going on in Montgomery County, where they have volunteers going on call to pick it up from restaurants and take it here and there. The challenge is you've always got this food, and it's perishable, and it's in certain quantities, and you got to get it from where it starts to where it needs to be used before it goes bad, and in the right quantities that they can use it, and it has to be good quality food.
So what does it take from both of you? Let's start, Ronnie, and then go to Brenda. What's it take to scale it up to make this effective? What does it take to scale it up?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say one of the big things is there's many things, but two things I would point to. One is funding for infrastructure to really, I mean, there's so many things that are almost no-brainers, but we need the investment. But the other is that we haven't really invested either in the evaluation to know exactly what works and how to improve it and how to identify what are the best programs out there. So when you've got 50 different programs, they all sound really cool. Which are the best ones? We don't yet know. So.
And how would you?
And I say that not just as a researcher.
No, right.
Funny,
right. So we have things to learn. So Brenda, how would you respond to that?
First, your question on scaling up is just an interesting phrasing, because at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, we are strong proponents of a distributed or decentralized or diverse infrastructure. I mean, we promote community solar over large-scale solar, for instance, or small-scale wind over large wind farms. And the same thing is for composting. I mean, there may undoubtedly, for the infrastructure, be needed some larger-scale facilities, but we had... Up until a few years ago, all of the food scraps, most of the food scraps collected in our region, Maryland and even Washington, D.C. and beyond, was going to a very large commercial industrial facility in Wilmington, Delaware. It was just too big, and it closed because it had contamination problems and odor problems. They couldn't sell the compost. And that's not to say composting can't work, but it's, to me, it's not a question of scaling up, but replicating and adapting. And I think that closing of that Wilmington facility really underscored the need for a diverse infrastructure, if you will. So, you know, where we are doing reduction of food waste, we are rescuing for edible food, we are doing backyard composting, we are doing some community scale sites. In addition to the Curtis Bay Filbert Street Garden site, we've been working very closely with Civic Works Real Food Farm, an urban farm in Baltimore, and they now are a drop-off of food scraps. And in D.C., not too far away, the D.C. Department of Parks and Recs has a network of 40 community gardens, and each of those gardens has a community compost and a community compost cooperative that not only can people join and drop off food scraps, but we also have food scrap collectors like Compost Cab that are delivering to a distributed network of sites, and their clients include cafes and restaurants in addition to households. So this just, you know, and then there's farmers, you know, and there's other scales. And so really I think that the question is to really, really embrace a diverse infrastructure. In Montgomery County, my group worked with the County Food Council, and we passed, worked with very closely with them, Council Member Roger Berliner, on a compost bill. And that bill calls for the development of an organics material recycling strategy that is very diverse. You know, you have to look at farmers. You have to look at doing on-site composting. You have to look at home composting. So I think legislation can help to set the framework. There is a bill in Maryland right now. If listeners can call your elected officials and tell them to support House Bill 171, Senate Bill 99, that's a bill looking at increasing the infrastructure for food waste and recovery, including looking at prevention. And that bill does call for a diverse and decentralized infrastructure to be looked at. And I think that's very critical, that we're not putting all our eggs in one basket.
So go ahead, and then we'll wrap up after this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to that, Brenda. I think you raise really good points, and I agree with you. And so when I was thinking of scaling up, I was talking about scaling up the volume of food that is recovered or recycled. So I wasn't necessarily thinking about it in terms of some vast facility. Just wanted to clarify.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Yeah. And I was not thinking you were thinking that, Ron.
So this is fascinating. We take a short break here, but when we come back, we're going to meet with some local folks who are actually doing this work in the community here in Baltimore and hear how that work's going. And it's going to be part of a ongoing conversation about this, which I think is a very critical subject for our future. And look forward to having both of these guests back. We've been joined by Brenda Platt, who is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, where she leads the Composting for Community program, and Dr. Ronnie Neff, who is the Johns Hopkins Center for Livable Futures Food Sustainability and Public Health Programs director. Is that right?
Program director.
Yeah, program director, right. And so I want to thank you both for being here, Ronnie and Brenda. This is really interesting, and we have a lot more to learn, and this is really could be cutting edge. And some of that's happening here in Baltimore and in Maryland. We'll have to continue this look with our guests and more. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Don't go away. When we come back, we'll be meeting local activists doing the very thing these women are talking about. Back, folks, to Soundbikes and the Mark Steiner Show right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Before we get back to our conversation, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From limiting overtesting to protecting public school funding, you can learn more about the issues facing Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, agriculture, the environment, and energy systems. That we do every week here on Thursday on The Mark Steiner Show. And right here, of course, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we continue our conversation. The last half an hour, we were talking with two folks with a kind of a national perspective. Ronnie Neff joins us from the Center of Livable Future and Brenda Platt from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. We're going to bring it totally local now. The two people who are in the midst of this issue around food waste and what to do it and feeding people and helping people feed themselves in our community and what that means. We're here with, once again, Michelle Antoinette. You know her as Love the Poet on our monthly segment together, Booth Stories, but she's here on a different purpose today. She's founder of Brown and Healthy. Good to see you.
Good to be here, as always.
As always. And joining her is Michael Dorsey, who is Director of Community Initiatives at the Chesapeake Center for Youth Development. And Michael, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I think Brenda Platt called your name out yesterday.
She did. We've worked together for a good deal of time. And if we even got to take a trip together. It was myself and her and Rodette Jones, who works for the Chesapeake Center for Youth Development. It's also a community member in Curtis Bay. And we did a tour in Philadelphia and New York of other local composting efforts that are surrounding organic community-based gardens and local ways that you can do food scrap collection or organic community composting, or ways that we're not just letting this food go to the landfill and contributing to so much that's worth.
Which is why she was talking about you.
That makes sense. It was a good trip too. We had a lot of fun.
I want to hear more about that in the course of the conversation. And Michelle, so I had no idea you were in the midst of this stuff. Talk about what you're doing and who you're doing with the women from Dovecote Cafe.
Yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Dovecote Cafe is just one amazing entity in Reservoir Hill. And, you know, their presence is echoing throughout the city. And they partnered with the Baltimore Free Farm initially, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, to bring...
Over in Hamden.
I'm not sure exactly where they're located. But they partnered with them to bring free produce to Dovecote at 4 p.m. on Thursdays, every Thursday. And it had such a large effect on me and my household. I think it probably cut our grocery bill like in half, being able to go there. So it's not just produce, but they also do groceries. So that's the big drop. That's about 600 pounds of produce. And then they bring like groceries from, I think it's like Mom's or somewhere. But so they bring that in, they do that. And so it affected me in such a way. And I was talking with Aisha, who's a great friend of mine, and we partnered to do the Brown and Healthy Speaker Series and other things. And since Brown and Healthy has like a volunteer base and the social capital and, you know, just the hands and the feet on the ground, I was like, how can we help? And so we've partnered with them to expand it to an initiative where we'll go to the food center and get the produce. And actually, we made it kind of a double thing. So we volunteer for the food center as well to sort it. So mm-hmm. anything that's like terribly old or damaged, we set aside for them for composting, and then we pick what we need for our haul, take that, and then, you know, come down to Dovecote, and from 2 to 4 on Tuesdays and Fridays, we set up a mini produce stand. We only do about like 100, 150 pounds of produce.
Where's the produce come from?
Maryland Food Center. So that's in Jessup. So, yeah.
So this is food that would be thrown away otherwise?
Yeah, and they set it aside for donations. So a lot of people come and pick, other people who are doing initiatives or, you know, like, I don't know if they're giving food to the homeless or whatever, come through as well. Sometimes we intersect with people who are coming through to get some stuff. But otherwise, it just goes to waste. And let me just tell you how much food gets set aside and just goes bad. And, I mean, that's one of the most overwhelming things. And when they gave us the tour, I was just overwhelmed by the amount of food that just does not get eaten. And you know, we have all these people who are hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And what's even more important about the initiative that really stuck out to me was it's not just for the poor and super underprivileged. It's for the working class person who typically, and this is what Brown and Healthy is really about changing the narrative around us existing. Either, you know, in this world where you're either, like, the wire or we're non-existent. And it's like, no, there are people who are in this health and wellness industry. There are people who are working every day who get overlooked. And when some people see us functioning well or whatever, however we're looked at in this community as brown people, they often say, well, what are you doing for the underserved? But I'm like, in not acknowledging that there are several layers of my life that's underserved, you know what I mean? That's doing me a disservice as well. So we're providing opportunity for people who make too much for, like, food stamps, but might not be able to, are choosing between getting groceries and their BG&E bill, paying their BG&E
right,
bill.
Which is very common
right.
in this town.
Right. Right. And so we're servicing everyone. We're not saying you can't come here because you have an apartment and a car. You know what I'm saying? Like, right. Come here because you have an apartment and a car and you need this food. And we're opening you to the idea of produce, and it's all different types of produce. We're actually doing food education. We're telling people what it is. We're helping them Google it. We're helping them find recipes. So it's like, you know, several layers. And this partnership is just one of what's going to be, you know, many. But that's what we're starting with. And we ultimately want to get to a point where we're 7 days a week. So right now it's 3 days a week.
3 days a week. Well, mm-hmm. Let me come back to that. Okay. You raised a bunch of issues here that we're going to explore in some depth. But Michael, so the stuff you all do, Michael Dorsey, at Chesapeake Center for Youth Development, is a little different, right? Are you also working with food, or are you working with primarily composting and taking waste and helping create composting piles? And if you are, where does that go?
I'm going to say all of the above.
All of the above. All right.
So we started a community initiatives department at the end of, or the middle of 2015. July, and it has four basic tenets that it's founded upon. And so it's everyone has the access to outdoor recreation, everyone should have access to healthy foods, everyone should get park and community stewardship as part of their neighborhood, so that we can all have, doesn't matter what income level or what development level, but ways that we can make ourselves proud of our communities. And then green jobs has been something that we've worked towards. So one of our systems is, how can we look inside the community, create urban farming opportunities, and then bring food to people that are in a tremendous food desert? Mm-hmm. The amount of time it takes people in Brooklyn and Curtis Bay to reach a grocery store is 300 to 400% of the time it takes people in the rest of the city on average to reach a grocery store. And that's not even to mention they don't have a lot of vehicular access, again, in comparison to the city of Baltimore at average. So you've got this forgotten community in this little peninsula. And so what we're doing, you know, a little peninsula in South Baltimore, what we're doing is we're setting up farm stands multiple times a week at different places on both sides of the community to have what we call low-cost, no-cost veggies. These are things that are all organically grown in the open space that we manage. And then we're also encouraging them to take that and get better access to healthy foods in general. So we have a partnership with the health department that's called Virtual Supermarket, and it brings ShopRite to deliver groceries to the community itself. So that's where our food access component is right there, that we're trying to take space that's not being used, utilize it, and grow food for the community, and then essentially give it away. But we're also trying to build jobs with the same concept.
How do you build jobs when you're giving stuff away?
Well, so not everything gets given away, because
right.
not everyone takes everything.
Right.
What doesn't get given away but does, you know, get harvested goes for sale at the farmer's market and the Waverly Farmer Market underneath the Farm Alliance flag. So if you get a little purple ribbon at the Farm Alliance stand, it's coming from our farms. And that creates some degree of revenue. The concept around a lack of food waste and composting is creating a food scrap collection service for the Federal Hill Locust Point area, and then locally composting it at a community garden in Curtis Bay itself. And so we're actually having an interview for two high schoolers tomorrow to start this bike composting service, where they bike around Fed Hill and Locust Point and pick up food scraps at a small fee for service. And then it gets taken back and composted. And when the compost is finished, which takes several months, it gets given away to other community places that are looking to establish a garden or work to make sure that this urban food access or urban farming can happen right in their backyard, right in their open space, right in their community.
Wow.
Well, so it's interesting to me that there's so much going on in this town. And that's my guess. Is this the first time the two of you ever met each other?
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
good to meet you.
So I'm saying that because, I mean, this happens a lot in this program where people who are doing work on the city.
Yeah.
But our connections are...
It's very siloed.
Right. Mm-hmm. We are very siloed for many different reasons.
Yes.
And that's why it's important for me to make these connections. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about it, Michelle, you know, as you were talking that... I think a couple of things. How many people do you think you serve, and who are they? Are they mostly like, I mean, people from that community, or they go beyond that narrow Madison Avenue, Utah Place, Carter?
So I would say, because we really just got started last week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We just got started as an add-on to the program last week. But from what I have seen on the Thursdays, now that has grown because it's been going on for many months. People from all over the city who know about it come, and they're waiting in line. And as soon as it's time, they get whatever they can get, and it's take whatever you can carry type of thing. And I would say on Thursdays, it's probably between 4 and 5:30 before everything's gone. I'd probably say maybe like 50, 60 people, maybe even more. I'm kind of bad at those guesstimations.
Right.
But for us, between the hours, for now, with very little promotion, between the hours of 2 and 4, I would say we probably get about maybe like 20 people just, you know, in and out. And then there's the people inside the cafe who are there and who are working or whatever. They come out, they get what they need, they go back in. We're actually going to start like using like a clicker to like to be able to really quantify like how many people come. But it's the word is getting out, and every time somebody comes up, they're like, I saw it on Instagram. I saw you guys talking about it. I'm coming down. And what it allows for our timing, the Tuesdays and Fridays, is for the people who are like, I can never make it on a Thursday. You know, but I want to get this. So the expansion of it is what's going to help more people be able to make it down before
right.
the food is gone.
Right.
You know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So I'm curious where you all think this, A, what you think the need is, citywide, and B, where do you think this will go? Where could it go? Where could it conceivably go?
Well, it's a lot of different issues at the same time. And sometimes it's hard to make sure that it comes together in a comprehensive, cohesive plan. I mean, some of what we're talking about here is taking away the food waste that's already going to be thrown away
right.
and making sure that doesn't reach the dump. Because no matter what we do or what the way the industry's set up, it's going to reach the dump and it's going to cause huge waste problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so simply taking that and diverting it and giving it to people in general is just better for the planet. And then also addressing the needs of people that can't quite afford their food bill or don't have the understanding of what the access to healthy food means to them and their families, and learning how to plan their meals and get that access regularly and make sure that there's no question about having a full, healthy, local plate. And then the next one is about where's the job growth? How can we create opportunities that are local to this specific spot and develop the infrastructure of this struggling community so there's more opportunities for everyone that's involved?
Yeah, I agree. And I also think that people don't know what they need until you tell them. That's kind
That's
of like
interesting.
It's kind of a sales thing, right? So if I'm in a community where I've got to say I'm in closer to Mondawmin where there's a Shoppers and it's a grocery store right there and I'm in that area, but I don't know that I can get that same watermelon down the street for low cost or absolutely free, where, you know what I mean, where I can also find that there's a network of people and that there's a community of people who, you know, are here for me. And I think it's for us, it's about building community as well and saying that we're looking out for each other in this space in Baltimore, not being siloed, us talking and having a conversation about, I didn't know what goes on in Curtis Bay, you know, and like just having that interconnectedness where it's like taking that stand, if we do pop-ups throughout the city, which we plan on doing, and taking that stand and saying, hey, we're giving you this because we don't want you to just have to walk through the grocery store and walk past it. Because that's also the case. Like, we're talking about produce in a neighborhood where I went to a grocery store and the young man who was ringing me up didn't even know that I had, like, what is this? And it was beets. Well, he's like, what is this? And he's working there. You know what I'm saying? So
right.
I think there's
Clark?
An education. Yes.
Wow.
Right. You don't think about these things until it happens. And he was an intelligent young man. It's just that he doesn't eat those. You know what
right.
I'm saying?
Right.
And why not? And why are we in a community where, and I always talk about this, I have a big beef with it, but we're in a community where our radio stations, our main radio stations are saying like they're McDonald's studios, and there's 365 McDonald's in the community, in the black community, and it said so much, other people don't hear it, but because they put so much money into our stations and into everything, that's what comes up. There's a Twitter, McDonald's has its own Twitter, but they have another one, and it's at 365 Black. It's focused. It's on purpose.
Really?
Yes. Look it up. They have a whole website and a whole initiative that is focused, purposed toward people of color and making sure we eat that nonsense that is not food. So
365 days out of the year, is that the...
It's 365 days in the black community. That's the tag.
It is.
And it's hidden under giving people awards and doing all these other things, but not even really hidden. It's a focus.
365black.com is a new social space for celebrating African American history and culture 365 days a year.
Right. That's not what that is. Before they even started that website, it was on the radio, and it was just basically saying, we're here and come get the food. All, if you look at the commercials, all of them now have mainly black people in them, and it's geared specifically for us to go and eat that trash. And so for me also, and this is important because why we got in part of the initiative, because I'm like, that's not food, and we have to start educating on what.
So McDonald's is also, this is a little digression, we'll go right back to main subject though.
Yeah.
Because it's important. McDonald's is also is the sponsor of the CIAA Basketball Championship, mm-hmm. which is the Historically Black College University's athletic league.
Yeah. Welcome to my war.
So the war takes the war, as you put it. I mean, this comes on many different fronts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if 40% of the food we use in this country is thrown away,
mm-hmm.
that number has to be that or more in our metropolitan area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also not just from grocery stores and restaurants, but from stuff that's not gleaned from the fields that farmers don't harvest for any number of reasons. That is also thrown out. You know, Arthur Morgan could make it today, but Arthur Morgan goes out there and gleans the fields and brings food in.
He's in Jessup right now.
Right.
He's getting that food that we were talking about earlier and bringing it out. And Gather Baltimore is taking all those foods that would be considered unsellable because they're ugly.
Yeah, that's
quote,
what we do as well.
Mm-hmm. They take ugly fruit, which means it's not shelvable.
Mm-hmm.
It looks, people would say, oh, no, there's a much better looking one next to it. And so it's because it's produce. Its shelf life won't last long enough for it to be purchased by the average consumer.
Right.
So we're taking a vast degree of what's being grown in our fields and we're throwing it away because it doesn't look pretty enough to fit this picturesque commercial ideal, or it's not lasting long enough and it's you know, natural shelf life is going away. But by taking that food before it spoils and preparing it or putting it to people that will use it and don't care, because you get a mashed potato, it doesn't matter how it started, and you get, you know, it doesn't matter what it looked like in the beginning.
Yeah.
When you have,
yeah,
you have sauteed veggies,
I like
you know, you get carrots and green beans and zucchini, you put it all and you stir fry it. It doesn't matter how they looked in the beginning. They're all chopped up and cooked and prepared, and then they taste just the same.
Cut it up, freeze it, juice it, something.
So are you, but you're teaching.
Yeah, we're
teaching people how to cook these things that probably never cooked before. You know, I guess you're the same, right?
Yeah. Well, we as much as we can. Like, if somebody has a question, we'll like help them Google it, or we'll Google it, or talk them through it, or we'll look up recipes. And for me, for like people that I know that come down there and they're really curious and they hit me up later or something like that, I'll find something for them and actually send it, like links. I a very personal one. I took some to my dad. You know, old. You know, and he's aging, and you know, he was really appreciative of it, and he was like, "Well, what do I do with this?" I can't remember exactly what it was. Jicama, JICAMA.
Oh yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, and so we sat there together, and that was a real moment. But that's
right.
You know, realizing those types of things. Yeah, trying to educate people.
So, I mean, the education, it comes back to a question of capacity and a question of demand.
Mm-hmm.
So, what is our capacity to help try to educate the community on the values of healthy food? And we host monthly cooking classes in our community kitchen at the Chesapeake Center for Youth Development. But, you know, despite the fact that people are coming there, they're getting freshly produced food prepared for them, shown how to do it, given a recipe. Sometimes we still only get 3 or 4 people showing up. I mean, don't get me wrong. We've had, you know, 15, 16 and some larger crowds in the past, but sometimes it's not that high. So there's the demand and there's the sense of our capacity. We can't do that all the time unless we get some of that community
right.
involvement.
You know, and I was thinking about the jicama.
Yeah.
It's this jicama.
Okay.
It's a yam bean,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But a big yam bean.
Right.
So,
I have to try one.
Yeah, it's a Mexican vegetable. But but anyway, I mean, digression to jicamas. But so I'm curious, you know, where do you think this takes logic, where this goes? I mean, so there are two levels here, it seems to me. One is the work you all are doing in communities to make a change because you're in the grassroots communities. You're making a change because you think it has to be done, and you're there doing it. If you scale this thing up, what makes that change? You know what I'm saying? I mean, what has to be done to, like, say we can eliminate the notion of food deserts through picking up food that is what we call waste, or creating composting in communities all over the city. People can kind of grow and also do their own and learn. I mean, what do you think it takes to scale this up?
I think I get a good firsthand opportunity when we set up outside of DevCoat, because a lot of artists and people who are more into like change, social change, and doing things in the community, they feel empowered. They see that people are actually not just talking, but doing. And not only are they doing, they're doing it in their community where
yeah.
they live, and providing something for them, wherein they might not always get that. They're like, oh, wow, this is for me and it's for free? Like, I don't have to pay you? Because that doesn't usually happen in areas like that. So when you have people like that who are seeing that it's not about lip service, you know, we're always talking about what we want to do, but they're there, and now we're having these real conversations about how can I help, how can I volunteer, and I get that all the time. So now we're getting this huge push of people wanting to volunteer and partner. And Dominic Nell from City Weeds, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He also Farmer Nell. He also does like microgreens. He lives right above Cafe. He was down there. He was like, he said to Aisha and I yesterday. He said, how can I help? And then we gave him another piece of the initiative, and he said, well, maybe that's something that I can jump in on and help you expand. So realizing, one, that not everything, you can't always do everything, and that
right.
partnerships, and that causes such a ripple. Right now there is a huge ripple, a huge wave rising in people being not only just wanting to do something for the community, but there are also people who live on stages, who have huge social capital, who are artists, and now are like, you know what, I can get involved in this too, and let me help you spread the word, and let me help you with manpower. So I think that there's a real groundswell around what we're doing specifically, and I'm sure once we get involved and get to know what you're doing, we can help with that. But I think there's a huge groundswell with the people who are mouthpieces and have been for over a decade in this city, and if not more, using their social capital, their level of like fan base and all that stuff to like say, hey, how can I, you know what I mean? Like, I think that is what is going to help make this a really big thing. And ultimately, I do see us being able to, from the ground up, eradicating a lot of the food deserts, like what they're doing down on Pennsylvania Avenue. You know, Tiffany Welch and them, they've been down there doing the produce market at the Avenue Market, you know, and all of us know each other. And now we're all in the capacity of being able to connect the dots. And I think that's it, like seeing how
mm-hmm.
you can get in there, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, well, yeah. Growing it organically.
Yeah,
no
basically.
Pun intended.
Yeah.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say the three keys are education, visibility, and experience. You've got a lot of impoverished areas where it hasn't been their experience that they access healthy foods on a regular basis. It is their experience that they access corner stores and fast food mm-hmm. Because that's what's available in their communities. Because
right.
the economy of scale doesn't have a local grocery store that's right there, so they don't have the access in the first place. If you change their experience, you change their normal, and you give them access to those healthy foods, their understanding what that experience is a big deal. And then you start small and you do put local or food in these local healthy or in local corner stores, put healthy food there. You do start farm stands in those places. You do start produce markets there. You do start farmers markets there. And so by taking it on a very small scale level and growing it from that beginning capacity, it'll push things forward. And then the demand for local produce or produce in general will exist in that community. And the market will respond to it. And it you won't have corner stores that are just stocked with sticky buns and Coca-Colas. It'll be something that's much fresher and much better for our health as a community, as a city, as whole, in a whole.
Yeah, and to that point, like, we've had opportunity to sit down with the Baltimore City Health Department, and so we've helped. We're getting involved with the health initiative for healthy corner stores.
Yep.
Where like I walked.
We are as well.
Yeah. So yeah, I've walked them into a corner store, let her, you know, in my neighborhood, in my own personal neighborhood, and was like, I introduced them, and you know, they're working now to fund an area in the store where they can put healthy produce and show them how to shelve it and do all those wonderful things. We also just recently got the grant. There's a grant for training teens, because you know we do the Brown and Healthy Kids program. Yeah, Youth 2.0. I was like, that's the short version of the name. but we just, you know, got that, where we're gonna take our young people and they'll be nutrition specialists and be outside of corner stores.
Does the whole thing have a name that you're working on?
That's with the Baltimore State Health Department. We just got the grant. They call it Youth 2.0.
What do you call yourself? Do you have a name for the project you're working on?
Oh, what do you mean?
As a whole.
Oh, well, with our kids programming, it's called Brown and Healthy Kids.
Okay.
And that's when we do health, wellness,
and the stuff you're doing with Dove Coat and giving out the food.
Oh, no. They just call it the Produce Pop-Up.
That's it? Yeah. I like the Produce Pop-Up.
The Produce Pop-Up, says. Yeah. So, right. Yeah. So, like to your point, like, as far as, like, getting into the corner stores, we're working with that as well. So
every time you're giving away the food to the community members, you're changing their experience, yes, around what it is to eat. And you're giving them an opportunity to be better educated about that. And then you're going to change their demand, mm-hmm, as they move forward.
That's right.
This has been fascinating. This is just the beginning. We're really going to cover this a great deal more in the coming weeks and months, because I think it's a really very critical issue that people are doing from the grassroots up. And we need to change things so that it envelops and engulfs the entire city. So Michael Dorsey is Director of Community Initiatives at the Chesapeake Center for Youth Development. Michael, good to meet you. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you very much.
Michelle Antoinette Nelson, a.k.a. Love the Poet, here in a very different capacity today, founder of Brown Healthy. Good to have you in the studio.
Good to be here.
What days are you doing your stuff at Utah, on Utah?
We are Tuesdays and Fridays from 2 to 4 p.m., and it's on Madison
Avenue. Madison Avenue.
Dove Coat Cafe.
Dove Coat Cafe. Mm-hmm. When is your stuff happening?
During the warm months, we have farm stands on Thursdays in different locations, and then the composting service, which will start in the next couple weeks, employing a couple high school youth, will be on the weekends. We'll be collecting your food.
And we will be linking to some of the stuff these guys are talking about, both these people are talking about, on our website. So, Michelle, good to have you in the studio, and Mike, good to have you in the studio. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media, and made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our senior producer is Mark Gundry. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagar. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Morgan Senior Michael Dixon. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Please send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. The podcast of Mark Steiner Show, and share it with your friends. Just visit us on the web at steinershow.org, or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.